It is the first week of July. It's the first day of July. And I am in studio with Sean Gladden. I almost forgot your name. I'm sorry.
All right, no problem.
And he is the executive director at the Howard County Historical Society. But you also mentioned that you're part of HCC.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've been teaching history here at HCC for coming up on my 10th year.
Wow. Yeah, wow, yeah. That's great.
I'm what they call a senior adjunct instructor.
And how does one get to be a senior adjunct instructor? Is it the number of years? Or
yeah,
is it...
you got to teach a certain amount of classes. And yeah, it goes from, you know, adjunct to, I believe, master adjunct to senior adjunct. And
oh,
then
wow.
There's nothing after. I joked around with the department and said they ought to like have a Jedi level so I can achieve to be higher, but I guess I'll just sit at senior and just continue to do my thing.
I love that. That's great. That we should make a motion for that.
I agree.
And Sean, tell us a little bit. I we're here to talk about, you know, July 4th is just coming up this week, and history. It's a fascinating thing to me, and it's interesting because it says that it comes in waves, right? That it repeats itself, and
yes.
I think that it's the more that I look back and the more that I see where we are, maybe, you know, I mean, obviously the people who are involved have changed, but it's true. I mean, it's a cyclical thing, and it's kind of like we forget in many ways, which is kind of unfortunate.
Yeah.
You know, because some things come back and it's not the best things that come back, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But then there's other things that we look back and it's like we've grown from there. And that's I think, the beauty of history and the challenge in history. I don't know if you agree with me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously the common phrase is that, you know, history repeats itself. Or, you know, if you don't pay attention to history, you're doomed to repeat history, all these different things. I like to sometimes, especially when I'm, you know, giving lectures or teaching my courses, I try to alter that phrase a little bit and say, human beings have the same patterns. We generally, although some of the details may be different, the things we fight about politically are the same. You know,
right.
More government, less government. How to deal with the social inequities and the economic inequities. I mean, these things, this is as old as human civilization itself. And then, you know, our natural inclination to war and our natural inclination to, you know, all of these things, these general themes repeat themselves constantly. These are the patterns. And so sometimes, you know, as historians, I think our benefit to society is that we've seen these patterns play out before,
right,
in history. And when you see the signs playing out again,
yeah,
sometimes that's where you can be of benefit, I guess. But, you know, I mean, the question I get all the time is, are we living in the most politically divisive time in our history?
Because
that's what people always get focused on, the present.
Right.
And of course I say, well, we did have that thing called the Civil War, and you know, the 1850s was pretty rough. But, you know, the 1960s were pretty politically divisive. The 1920s were, although, you know, the 1920s is a time that I like to point out is very similar to where we are today.
Really? Why is that?
Well, economically, we're in the early 1920s. The economy is very good.
Okay.
We have shifted noticeably to the right politically after being relatively progressive for a period of time before that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of a rejection of the progressiveness politically. Anti-immigration feelings, this 1920s had tons of immigration restriction laws. The culture wars were definitely the 1920s. So we're seeing, there are a lot of parallels in human patterns that we're seeing in the 1920s. And, you know, it was just like we're living in today. The economy's doing well.
Yeah.
There are some signs that that things are going to turn soon. But it's
again, speaking of the cycles, right? Yeah, because it's interesting because people say we're due for that. It's like we've already had this many number of years. Like there's theories of the number of years that you have that go by before you hit one of those. I remember back to high school, they were saying 50 years. It's 50 years in cycles where a country goes, you know, in the roller coaster economical cycle. And, you know, it's interesting that we can measure things that way.
It is. I mean, I will say, as someone who's, you know, studied history and taught history, it is eerie the way that sometimes things seem to be cyclical and that they follow these certain patterns. And you can pick up on these patterns. I mean, it certainly makes for interesting conversation and good explanation. But yeah, I mean, definitely there are cyclical patterns in history and
you know, fashion even repeats itself. I know that in the 70s, the pants that my mom used to wear were those really wide, you know, she calls them elephant like pants, and you see them now, you know, we see them now. It's like that 70 feel has come back in fashion. That's what you look at when you go to the mall, when you go shopping.
It's like I've always said with fashion is one of those things where something gets hot, everybody jumps on it, and then everybody gets sick of it. You just need to let it go away for a certain amount of time, and then they'll come back. They always come back.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's interesting. The hair, I really have to say, though, I don't want the hair, the poofy hair, to come back.
You don't want that 80s hair to come back.
It takes too much time. It takes too much time. I think that it's and too much spray, so it's not good for the environment. So.
I mean, those hairspray companies, when, you know, they were killing it in the 1980s.
So. Right. Right. And everybody liked them. So, I mean, who's to say that it might not come back, right?
That's right. Could.
It could. So, let's move a little bit into July the 4th. You know, that's coming up. And let's just talk about the history behind July the 4th. Why do we celebrate July the 4th?
Well, it is our Declaration of Independence Day, July 4th, 1776.
Did something special really happen in July 4th at some point in time that made this?
It was the actual day that the Declaration of Independence was signed. And if you think about it from a historical standpoint, I think we as Americans become so, you know, we love our history so much. And we talk about the 4th and we celebrate the 4th with hot dogs and fireworks and all these things. But sometimes I think it's as historians, we look at it as, I mean, what an amazing time in human history for this colony or these series of colonies to completely declare their independence from what was the most powerful empire in the world at the time. I mean, to some extent, I mean, this might be a little bit of a stretch, but it'd almost be like, what if Puerto Rico tomorrow decided that they were going to declare independence from the United States?
Well, and you know, I'm really glad that you brought that up because I printed this article that was kind of talking about it. And it's not that war stopped. And please correct me if I'm wrong, because what the article reads here is that it was basically a decision, right? It was basically the second attempt for a declaration. They had already had a meeting and decided kind of like that they were going to declare independence, but nothing had really happened until July the 4th when they actually signed that. But war continued. So they were not free necessarily because the war was still there. It was just an act of, I mean, almost like defiance. Can we say that?
Yeah, I would even go one step further. So the American Revolution pretty much begins in Boston, although there had been many gripes amongst many of the colonists. The mercantilist policies of the British, you know, they were, and you know, when we look at what the founding principles of our nation are, most of the founding principles of our nation are in response to what the British had forced upon us. Things like I said, these mercantilist policies, which was basically economic control of the colonies. Mm-hmm. You know, we could not, there was no free market in the colonies, although we had many, we were the producers of many raw material, right? Tobacco was coming out of the colonies. Indigo, items that were imported from the Caribbean and then exported through the colonies, you know, coffee, you know, fruit, you know, all of these things that were exporting from colonies. But who was really making the money was the British.
Right.
You know, the British companies like the Dutch East India Company, which could pretty much monopolize trade. They also said that, you know, if you were a colonist, if you were a colonial exporter, you could only export your goods through the British. You couldn't say trade with the Spanish or the French, basically completely limiting any opportunity for any kind of free market ideology. Mm-hmm. And so when men and I'll kind of turn us back to more local stuff. When you talk about a man like Charles Carroll of Carrollton, right, who was a planter here and lived in this part of Anne Arundel County. We weren't Howard County until 1851. We were Anne Arundel County until then. And Charles Carroll was a pretty wealthy Irish planter. You know, his opposition to these British policies was basically like, look, you guys are taking money out of my pocket. Like, there's an opportunity here for these men like Washington and Jefferson and your founding fathers, you know.
Right.
There was an opportunity for them to have their own economic freedom. That's really the driving factor behind it. But the more radical stuff was going on up in Boston. And that's where we really see the revolution kind of occur almost by accident. And so while the fighting begins in Boston in 1775, the discussions in Philadelphia, as they brought all of these different delegates together, is what are we going to do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And independence was not something that, at least in 1775, was a discussion. They kept talking about an olive branch, like they wanted to basically use their position to negotiate with the British crown. But
It says here, no taxation without representation. Right. That's kind of what they were looking for. It's like, why are we giving money when we are not getting all of the benefits, right? And we are not really part of it. I'm really glad that you brought Puerto Rico up, because it really reminds me so much of the situation that Puerto Rico has today compared to the States, to what the States was to the British back then.
How about Washington, D.C.? Washington, D.C. has no representation.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why the Washington, D.C. License plates have the no taxation without representation.
And I always wondered, you know, where that came from. Yeah. So it's really interesting to see that it comes back from the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, well, these men they form the Continental Congress during when hostilities had broken out. And initially their main gripe was that these policies, mainly these economic policies, were put on them by the British without them having any say. Meanwhile, the British figure, well, look, you have royal governors who are appointed by the British, so you're virtually represented. and it just wasn't good enough. So there were disagreements in what representative government should have been. And while this war was going on, they shifted from 1775 going into 1776. Well, in 1776, a very influential author by the name of Thomas Paine writes this pamphlet called Common Sense, which basically is like, hey, you know, it's common sense to be – basically, common sense – is the driving factor for the ideology of we should just be independent.
Hmm.
We've got our own economy. We've got our own representative governments. England is all the way over there. It doesn't make any sense for us not to be independent. And within a few months, you see many of these men who had been debating at the Continental Congress finally are now discussing the idea of completely breaking from England and being independent. And the 4th of July and the signing of the Declaration of Independence is more than just a Declaration of Independence. What it is it takes this conflict, this war that had been going on for about a year, and gave it a real war aim. Now we're like, look, we're no longer just fighting for our economic rights or fighting for equal representation. We now are fighting to be independent. And that kind of changes the game a little bit. For the most part. Although, as I say in my classes all the time, I'm like, but think about it. The men that signed that document, basically, they had to win the war. Otherwise, they were signing their own death warrant.
Right.
Because all of those men were going to be hung as traitors if they were caught. So it's definitely an interesting document. It's an interesting process how we got there. And And it wasn't even a foregone conclusion that we were going to win that war. Things right. were in the months after the Declaration of Independence was signed. I mean, it's probably some of the worst times for Washington and his army. So definitely interesting.
So the July 4th date is the signage of the Declaration of Independence, but the actual winning of the war did not come until
1781. So the war goes on for 5 more years.
Yeah. Are people celebrating July 4th in the meantime? Are they starting to No.
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, that's a good question. I don't. When the celebration of the 4th of July began, You know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and say, without actually having done the research, I'm pretty sure the Declaration Day, July 4th, probably wasn't really celebrated until after the war was over.
Okay.
Because you don't celebrate something that hasn't really happened yet. Because they had to win the war to get their independence.
Right.
And I'll tell you, the first couple of years were not looking good for the Continental Army. But eventually, we score a couple of big victories in 1777.
Mm-hmm.
The French then decide to be our allies, and then the tide turns. And eventually, it was just a matter of waiting the British out. In a way, you know, one of the things about the American Revolution, in a way, we kind of showed how to defeat a larger occupying force. In the American Revolution. So the same tactics that we use against the British, to some extent, are the same tactics that the Vietnamese used against the United States during the Vietnam War. Certainly that idea of waiting your stronger, more militarily equipped enemy out and making the war unpopular on their front.
Mm.
Because, I mean, the British, from a military standpoint, probably could have continued to fight, but
right.
it became so unpopular at home and so expensive. And the media, right? We talk about the media
right.
turned against them. So
right.
so eventually, you know, the British just, you know, it was over. You know, they couldn't fight the war anymore. So
strategies win wars is what I like to say. You know, it's more than the force. I think that you really win it at the table, not
yeah.
so much in the front lines. That's my thought of. Anyways,
yeah, certainly, yeah.
So, locally, let's you know, bring all of this locally. Mm-hmm. What was happening now that we get a very good understanding of, you know, the broad, I guess, understanding of how July the 4th came to be? What was happening here locally? Yeah. What are some of the, you know, the highlights here in, I guess, Anne Arundel County at that time?
Right. Yeah, actually, there are quite a few, very little, actually, there weren't battles or anything that actually occurred here in this part of what would be Anne Arundel County. But we have quite a few interesting individuals
mm-hmm.
who come from this area. Obviously, probably the biggest name is Charles Carroll of Carrollton, whose ancestral home, I guess you could say, is Doregan Manor, which is still the Carroll family still lives there.
Mm.
It is in the western part of Howard County, right past the HCYP baseball fields out there on Frederick Road.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, the Carrolls have lived there, and still the descendants of Charles Carroll of Carrollton still lives there. In the 1700s, Charles Carroll of Carrollton is a influential planter and figure. He's Catholic, and being Catholic and a man of wealth and prestige in Maryland usually went hand in hand. Maryland was usually a place where if you were Catholic, it was a little more tolerable. The rest of the colonies very much were very Protestant. So Maryland was historically always been kind of a Catholic refuge. But Charles Carroll had made quite a bit of money as a planter. His father was influential politically. And so he built this house he didn't build the house. He lived in Doregan Manor. And he becomes a figure politically because the fact that he is Catholic. One of the things during the Revolution is that the Patriots thought that they had a common ally in the Canadians. Who had lived under British rule since the end of the French and Indian War, but But and they thought that if one of their delegates were a Catholic, mm-hmm. an Irish Catholic like Charles Carroll, it would help with their relationship with not only with trying to entice Canadians to rebel against the British as well, but eventually when the French, and most of the French are mostly Catholics as well, that there would be a, that Charles Carroll would be a nice kind of go-between. But Charles Carroll is one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Okay.
He was one of the delegates from Maryland. Interesting to note that originally, when after the – so the process leading up to the Declaration was, you know, state delegations had – or state state legislatures at the time, or which were called oh, boy. Here's one of those things. You know, you got so much stuff right around in there. Sometimes, each colony had its own assembly. That's what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Each colony had its own assembly, and these assemblies were made the decisions based on what the constituents wanted to do. And originally, Charles Carroll was given instructions to vote against independence from Maryland. But at some point in the negotiations, I guess they saw that the tide was turning, and finally when the final vote came for independence, that Maryland did, and Charles Carroll did vote for independence. It ended up being 12 of the colonies voted for it, none voted against, and New York abstained. And once that vote was done, then they...
Interesting.
New York abstained. New York was a notoriously loyalist state, at least, or colony, at least New York City was. So was South Carolina. They had a hard time accepting the idea of independence because New York and South Carolina was so economically tied to Britain. So New York had not gotten its instructions from its colonial assembly, so they had abstained. And they knew this vote was so important that they couldn't have... They had to be unanimous. So by abstaining, it still kept it, you know, no one had voted against it. And so they moved forward with it. But Charles Carroll was the delegate from this area.
Okay.
And then during the Revolution itself, you know, there were many very influential figures who, mm-hmm. who I would say as... From Howard County history standpoint, these are names that we should all know from a history standpoint. But the reason we know these names is because of all the street names around us. you know, some of the more influential names who all served in the Revolution were men, names like Warfields, Ridgelys, you know, Dorseys.
Okay.
You know, many of these family names began... you know, began their illustrious careers as fighting in the Revolution. There was a militia that had been formed out of this area. It was called the Elk Ridge Militia. Some of these men also served in the Severn Militia, which was further south in Anne Arundel County. But a lot of the men who fought in these militias would go on to be the prominent families after the war.
What was a militia? I'm going to stop you right there. What was a militia? What was the purpose of them?
Okay, so from a military standpoint, you're going to have a standing army, which are professionally trained soldiers, right? Mm-hmm. Who professionally trained, and they're in a standing army per se. A militia basically are citizen soldiers. Okay. They are not in a standing army. Instead, a militia is something that is mustered and outfitted when there is an emergency.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea is you're a farmer, an emergency comes about, you know, you put down the hoe, you put down the pitchfork, and you pick up your gun and you report for duty to defend.
Okay.
And now, originally, America was built on the idea of militias. Because we essentially won the Revolution with what was basically a citizen soldiery, that the idea was after the war that we would continue to be a citizen army. This is one of the reasons why there's so much debate about the Second Amendment. because the idea of us, the founding fathers' idea of us all being armed, was in the idea that we would all be ready for military service if such a thing arose. But
interesting.
See, but we have a standing army, and
well, so would they be fighting together if the time came to be and we still had the militia? And yeah. Was that the case back in history, in the revolutionary yeah. time?
Well, historically, going all the way back, even if you want to go back to the Roman army, the idea of a militia was to supplement the standing army if you had a standing got army. It. But see, and you got to put your mindset in the mindset of these men from this time. The reason they didn't want a standing army is the same reason they didn't want a king. A standing army and a king represented strong central power.
Right.
So the idea was, if we didn't have a strong central army, and instead the army was made up of average citizens like ourselves, and then when the military emergency is over, then we revert back to our farms. Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry about someone of power using a military force against the citizenry. So to some extent, like, you know, the discussions of how our country was founded in those important years between the Revolution and eventually the creation of the Constitution, our idea of what this country should have been changed.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we would have a standing army and a standing navy. But if you would have asked men like Sam Adams or somebody who was probably a little bit more radical against the idea of central power, they would have said, we can operate our entire military based on the use of militia. We don't need a standing army. What's the purpose of it? And So the idea of militia service was something that that most men in this area, able-bodied men, would have joined. And the Elk Ridge Militia eventually would be part of the Continental Army. And George Washington celebrated the men from Maryland. There was the Maryland 400 was like kind of an elite group that had that all were from various parts of Maryland. Some men were from our area, from Elkridge. And in, you know, George Washington's initial retreat out of New York, the Maryland 400 were the ones that staved off the British and allowed Washington to escape with his army. Historians say that if it wasn't for the Maryland 400, Washington's army might have been captured at New York, and then the war would have been over. You know, there's a lot of heroism that comes from these men. Marylanders always prided themselves back then as being tough and good fighters. And certainly, you know, men like Dorsey's, Ridgely's, Warfield's, these were the men that fought in these in this elite group, you could say. And after the war, many of them became very politically involved and now we have street names named after them.
And that's how we remember them.
That's right.
So, you know, we have just a couple more minutes left here in our conversation this morning. But knowing that part of history and knowing, you know, that Marylanders have always fought for what they felt was right? In the times that we are today, I mean, looking back and kind of like learning from that, what would you say to everybody listening and watching today? So...
what did I say about just Maryland?
Just looking, you know, maybe at today or maybe into the future, kind of like learning from, you know, those who represent Maryland.
I think Maryland's always been a very interesting state, and a lot of it comes from our geographic location. You know, we're not north, we're not south, you know, we're right there in the middle. We're that border state. And as a result of that, we've always been very diverse politically, economically, and we've always had very, very interesting figures have come out of Maryland. And I think the fact that Maryland has never really been historically has not really shifted one way or the other and kind of lives in this area in between has kind of evolved us politically to the point where we're usually, a little different from... You know, we don't usually go along with our southern brothers, and we usually don't go along too much with our northern brothers. We're kind of independent politically. I think that's something that is kind of born out of our geographic location. But certainly, Maryland, for whatever reason, has had some very influential and important political leaders in mm-hmm. its history. And even when we look, here at some of the men who've come out of Maryland and politically and have served, the men like Governor Warfield, men like Senator Clark, mm-hmm. we talk about the Clarks.
And, yeah.
You talk about many of these men come from this area. And if you look at what Howard County is at its core, was a hardworking farming community of people that understood the importance of hard work, independence, and as a result of that, we see some very important and very influential folks that we're proud to call Howard County natives. So I feel like I kind of jumped around your question to some extent, but Maryland's a unique place, mm-hmm. and we've been a major part of American history. You look at all the different historical markers and homes,
yeah.
and historical places around here. So I don't know. I guess that's the best way I can answer it. And how we are today. For example, here we have a Republican governor. I guess you could, if this will tie back to president, we have a Republican governor who doesn't march to the beat of what some of his other Republican, colleagues at the national level say. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good example of how Maryland's different. We tend to just be a little, do our own thing.
So we are progressive Republicans and we are... what's the word? We are, more cautious liberals. Would we be able to say that? Would that be fair?
I would say, Maryland, it depends on where you're talking about. Obviously, the Eastern Shore is still pretty conservative and Southern Maryland's pretty conservative. But we've always, in this part of Maryland, always been a little bit more liberal. This part where we are in Howard County, we had in the years leading up to the Civil War, we had a pretty strong anti-slavery community here in this part.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much on the Eastern Shore in Southern Maryland, but I think in and around this area, and certainly in and around Baltimore, we've always been a little bit left of center. But our friends out on the Eastern Shore and in Southern Maryland kind of balance us out a little bit. So, but yeah, I'd say historically, we've always been a little left of center,
okay.
And which certainly does not put us in the same political, realm as some of our neighbors. But so, yeah, we're somewhat unique like that.
So more of a balanced, state than in many ways.
But definitely more left. We're definitely more left.
So there's a little lenience there to one side over the other.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why, once again, going back to Governor Hogan, he's a good representation of that. He's definitely a conservative, don't get me wrong. but he leans left on a few things. Or let's say he leans center on a few things, which, outspoken in his... in his disagreements with the president and certainly with Congress. So, yeah, I think he is a good representation of what Maryland has been.
Historically.
Historically, yeah. Yeah, I think that's accurate.
And I think that's a good place for us to close. Thank you so much, Sean, for joining me this morning. It's been great to hear the history and finding really why we are going to see the fireworks, this coming July the 4th here. It's a big celebration that everybody looks forward to.
Yep.
And it's good not to forget why we do it. It's good to really understand why we have that big celebration. It's not that just somebody one day decided, I'm just going to light some fireworks up today.
Yeah.
And call it a day. It's there's a lot of history behind those lights that we see in the sky.
And I would say, also, it's more than just our holiday. Our independence changed the world.
Mm-hmm.
After our revolution, the French revolution occurred. And, you know, our independence inspired a lot of stuff around the world. So we're not really just only celebrating our independence. We're celebrating, you know, kind of that the freedom around the world that we kind of, I guess you could say.
Sparked.
That we sparked. There we go. With fireworks.
There you go. With fireworks.
Sparklers.
Just bringing it all together. Have a wonderful day, everybody. Thank Thanks, Sean, for joining me. And we're going to go back to our music. Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.